You're listening to the Party in My Plants podcast, and you're about to get this whole low FODMAP thing perfectly mapped out for you. Like Waze style mapping. Yeah, I like that. This episode is the Waze directions of low FODMAPping, which will get you to your final destination of digestive peace. All set? Let's go. Welcome to the Party in My Plants podcast, where I make healthy living as fun as a party so you'll, you know, actually want to do it and then actually feel, look, and live your best. I'm your host, Talia Pollock. Now let's get this party started. This episode is enthusiastically sponsored by a product I couldn't swear by more if I tried. Four Sigmatic Mushrooms. I didn't say swear about more. I said swear by. I couldn't swear by the magic of mushrooms more if I tried. I originally tried a packet of Four Sigmatic Mushroom tea in a glass of hot water because, well, I was gifted a free single packet of Four Sigmatic Mushroom tea by a friend. I had no idea what it did or what was going to happen to me. And I was skeptical because this whole mushroom thing is trendy right now. And I'm always skeptical of trendy things. Read, I avoid trendy things to not be trendy. You know what I mean? But anyway, I drank the shrooms and I felt truly awesome. It's hard to explain. I just felt more awesome than before I drank it. Since then, I've ordered it and consumed about 2 packets of shrooms a day, and I can't get enough. I am telling you, these mushrooms are magic. Although they don't make me hallucinate in a bathtub like my ex-boyfriend's famous magic mushroom experience, which honestly, he seemed way too proud of in hindsight. But hear this, I wasn't hallucinating the magical effects of these shrooms. They are ultra scientifically proven to boost immunity and gut health. Yes, please, and thank you. And the 4 different shrooms that Four Sigmatic uses most, hence the 4 in Four Sigmatic, I just got that too. Well, like 3 minutes ago. But they all do different epic things for your bod. Reishi helps you relax. Cordyceps give you non-caffeinated energy for sports and stuff. Lion's mane, which does not come from my lion's mane, boosts your brain. That one's easy to remember. And chaga is good for immunity issues, like when you're traveling or feeling run down and or both. Okay, enough blabbering from me. I just finished a mushroom matcha latte. Oh yeah, Four Sigmatic has mushroom matcha powder. If I could just stop blabbering for a damn second, I could tell you that because you listen to this podcast, thank you for that, you can save 15% off any and all Four Sigmatic shroom stuff you'll want to buy off their site, Four Sigmatic, FourSigmatic.com, using code PARTYINMYPLANTS. To save that 15%, baby. Man, maybe I had way too much mushroom matcha. Okay, onward to the show. My guest today is a lovely lady whom I warmly refer to as the fairy godmother of low FODMAPs. She refers to herself as a registered and licensed dietitian, a New York Times bestselling author, and a specialist in a low FODMAP diet and digestive health conditions. But I think the fairy godmother of low FODMAPs sums it up rather perfectly. I've received so many podcast question submissions about the increasingly trendy low FODMAP diet, and I wanted to bring on the best of the best to give us the lowdown. Get it? Low FODMAP, lowdown. The lowdown on low FODMAPs. Well, Kate is the best of the best, and not just because I say so, or because Boston Magazine awarded her the Best Dietitian Award in 2016, but also because she literally just co-authored the low FODMAP roadmap called The Low FODMAP Diet Step by Step. So get ready to finally figure out this whole FODMAP thingy-majiggy, which hopefully can help your stomach if you struggle, or will just help you understand WTF this FODMAP lingo is all ABOUT. Kate, I have gotten so many questions about FODMAP eating, and you are people's low FODMAP fairy godmother, so thank you so much for coming on my show today.
I'm really happy to be here. It's an important diet that helps a lot of people. And so I'm glad to share all the messages.
Awesome. Yeah. I can't wait to hear everything and clear up any questions that everybody has. So, but before we dive into, you know, FODMAP 101, I would love to hear how you developed your passion for helping people find digestive peace. Because from my experience, a passion like that really stems from one's own experience. My digestive struggles are what led me into this whole healthy living thing to begin with. So I'm curious, you know, if you could share your story.
Absolutely. Well, I've been a dietitian for almost 30 years. So I've always been really interested in science and diet and how that impacts health. But my life kind of got a little sidelined when I was pregnant at 30 years old with my middle son. And I was about 3 months pregnant and developed this just colicky belly pain and ended up in the hospital. And I had developed scar tissue from an ovarian cyst I had removed when I was 18. That's what they, you know, sort of presumed happened. And that scar tissue wrapped around my intestine and strangled about 6 feet of my small intestine. Oh, so I required emergency surgery when I was 3 months pregnant.
Oh my God.
Yeah, just totally. I mean, definitely life-changing. Obviously, your small intestine plays a huge role in absorption of nutrients. So I definitely had to kind of, you know, learn my way. They didn't provide very much insight as to what I could tolerate and what I couldn't. And subsequent to that, actually, about 10 years after my surgery, I developed a condition called small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And I was really ill.
Like, is that SIBO?
SIBO. Mm-hmm. Really ill for about a year and a half. My husband couldn't travel on business. Wow. We would be, you know, being at a party and I'd say, I feel like I have full-blown labor pain. Like, I can't even stand here. And the doctors were like, you look good. You know, I don't know. We don't know what's wrong with you.
Wow.
And so that is my digestive health story. When I learned about the low FODMAP diet in 2009, it was like all these bells and whistles went off because I said, oh my gosh, these are all the foods that are problematic for me. There's some science here. This makes sense. And that's how it all started.
Well, how did you first hear about it in 2009?
So I had the opportunity to write a book on irritable bowel syndrome. And
I mean, not just any book, The Complete Idiot's Guide to Eating Well with IBS.
Yeah.
All right.
There you go. So yeah, I did. And, you know, of course, like any good evidence-based practitioner, I delved into all the research and started seeing more and more literature on FODMAPs and the FODMAP approach. And so I incorporated that concept into my book and then followed up with a visit to the Melbourne, where the research was sort of developed in this area in Australia. I contacted them and ended up going there and visiting with them and learning from them, you know, how to apply this diet. And then all the patients started flooding my gates and all the questions on my blog were about FODMAPs. So my blog became a low FODMAP blog. And, you know, I think my followers have kind of dictated my direction. And certainly my own digestive health story has, you know, probably made me very credible and I'm science-based.
Yeah. So I've said you're the low FODMAP fairy godmother. That's your new name.
No, you know what? I love that because I'm here to help people. I know the struggles and I know what it feels like to be alone. And a lot of people are out there just like, there's so much misinformation online and, you know, I just want to make the journey as easy as possible.
Yeah, which is awesome. Well, let's talk a little bit about digestive health in general for a sec. So, I mean, you help people with IBS, celiac disease, inflammatory bowel disease, SIBO. I mean, these are all types of digestive disorders, but what are some of the key differences among them? Are there, you know, similarities? Like, talk to me about, like, what are the most popular? Like, what are you experiencing with the people you work with?
Yeah, so we're seeing, you know, it's interesting you asked that question because I have an office manager who's fabulous. And I said, you know, what's the changing dynamic? What are clients asking for? And she said, you know, it was all about FODMAPs, last year and this year, it's still about FODMAPs, but it's very much about small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Yeah, I think a lot of people, it's very trending. You know, maybe overdiagnosed in some people, maybe underdiagnosed in others. I think it needs, because the treatment tends to be some diet manipulation along with antibiotics, you know, we have to be careful about overdoing the antibiotics. I do worry about that, you know, just some patients come to me and they've been on 4 or 5 rounds of antibiotics, and that in itself, you know, don't do any harm. We have to be really careful with how we're managing it. But I am seeing a lot, what I would say trending is small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, which of course I'm incredibly empathetic to because I had it and it was miserable, and I know what's helped me, and I've been able to help thousands of patients. So small intestinal bacterial overgrowth is when your small intestine becomes seeded with microbes that normally shouldn't be there. The majority of them arrive from the colon and they start growing. And the problem with bacteria or microbes in your small intestine is they get to the food before the food is actually digested, because, you know, it takes your body a little while for the small intestine to break things down and absorb them into your bloodstream. So if the bacteria are there, they're going to get to that food, they're going to start fermenting it and creating a number of metabolites and gas, which stretches the small intestine, which really it's not designed to stretch like the colon is, can lead to a lot of bloating and cramping, feeling full, you know, very soon after eating. It can lead to fat malabsorption because the microbes get to the bile that is your gallbladder puts into your small intestine to help you digest fat, and they render the bile inactive. So there's a big cascade of GI symptoms. I kind of call SIBO IBS on steroids. It's like the worst. People, they feel pregnant when they're not pregnant. I mean, I definitely looked about 6 months pregnant every single night around 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It would just swell as the day went on. That's kind of classic SIBO, you know, experiences. And it's not pretty and it's not fun. And these patients are very misinformed with the information that's on the internet, and they go on very strict diets. And it's just a sad, they really need to go see a dietitian that has expertise in GI. You know,
specifically. Definitely. Well, my friend Phoebe Lapine, who's been on this podcast and who actually recommended you to me as the low FODMAP expert, she said, she is SIBO right now, and she said that it's really just like bacteria. That's not bad bacteria, but it's just like in the wrong place, is how she put it to me.
Like, that's absolutely correct. Yes. And I think that's one of the misconceptions. I think a lot of people think it's the bad bacteria, but it's not necessarily the bad bacteria. It's just bacteria shouldn't be.
Well, how does it happen? And why is it happening to so many people right now? Because I feel like either right now everyone's like learning about SIBO and is like, oh, wow, that's what I've had forever. I just didn't know. Or something's happening that everyone, not everyone, but like a lot of people are getting SIBO. Because when I was going through my digestive struggle journey, you know, like 9, 10 years ago, I don't even remember the word SIBO being thrown around. I guess I did that breath test. Is that how you test for it?
It is a breath test, but probably what you experienced was a lactose malabsorption breath test, which is commonly used. And it's a similar test, except in the SIBO breath test, the substrate that they give the person doing the test is either a glucose syrup or a lactulose syrup. Like the lactose breath test, which a lot of people have experienced, the substrate they actually give is lactose because they're trying to assess if someone's malabsorbing that lactose. In the glucose or lactulose breath test, they're looking to see what microbes are consuming. You know, are they consuming the glucose or the lactulose early, and are they making a lot of gas? And that is the way they determine if someone has bacterial overgrowth, because if there isn't a lot of bacteria, that glucose isn't going to be fermented into gas, which is what they use to measure whether someone has SIBO or not.
So basically the way to know, the test is a breath test.
It is.
With all the science stuff you just said.
Yes, with all that science stuff.
But so, you know I asked you like 12 questions during that one question, but why do you think it's so popular right
prevalent
now? Yeah, prevalent is the better word.
Well, yeah, I think that, you know, there's definitely a better understanding that bacterial, you know, metabolism affects symptoms, especially in people with irritable bowel syndrome. And they Mark Pimentel has done really, he's the maverick in this area of small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, and just looking at a number of different, you know, treatment, they've just explored the research a little bit more. So I think that, you know, like in any westernized country, we want to base our sort of diagnosis and treatments based on science, and the SIBO science just is kind of a newcomer. So we're just really learning about it and understanding it. For instance, there's no science, no study looking at diet and SIBO. So currently, as practitioners, we're modifying carbohydrates because we know microbes enjoy eating carbohydrates, the ones that are commonly malabsorbed. So we are modifying that, but we don't have like a set diet that science has proven to be beneficial.
Because it's early on. Yeah.
It's early on. But understanding how to treat it with antibiotics, that continues to emerge, and there's more and more studies. And so that in part is why we're hearing about it. I think more gastroenterologists are taking SIBO seriously, and they understand that there is evidence-based therapies from a antibiotic standpoint. So I think that's part of it. I do think we're seeing a little bit more. I think the 1980s, we did a number on our gut microbiome. We were, you know, really entrenched in ultra processed convenient foods. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad to see the nutrition climate changing and people understanding that what we eat feeds our gut bacteria, and it changes what's going on in our gut in one day. So, yeah. You know, yeah. It's important, but, you know, again, it's all just kind of coming together and we're putting all the pieces together.
Are there any actions that people can take to prevent themselves from developing SIBO specifically? I mean, I know celiac disease is, you can't, that's, you know, it is what it is.
Right.
You're born with it. I mean, I guess we'll talk about SIBO first, and then I do want to have a little IBS discussion, because
yeah.
It's not every day that I, with IBS, get to talk to the person who wrote The Complete Idiot's Guide to Living Well, Eating Well with IBS. So, but the question is, are there any lifestyle choices people can make to prevent SIBO?
So first of all, The Complete Idiot's Guide to Eating Well with IBS, I authored in 2009, and it's a great basic book on IBS, but if you're really looking at SIBO and current low FODMAP diet information, I'd highly recommend my latest book, which is The Low FODMAP Diet Step-by-Step, because this diet and diagnostic area continues to change. So if you want up-to-date information, I do recommend my latest book.
Which we'll dive deep into.
Definitely. But just to specify that for your listeners, because I think that's important, because the landscape has changed so dramatically.
So is The Complete Idiot's Guide not so complete, would you say, anymore?
Well, I think that there's some really good basic IBS tenets to really understand the IBS body in that. But as far as the nutritional recommendations, I think we've really kind of with the evidence, we've really encourage people to modify FODMAPs. That's really the most evidence-based diet for IBS. And
It's
sort of only introduced in The Complete Idiot's Guide, where the low FODMAP step-by-step really dives into it.
Because you learned about the low FODMAP while you were writing the book promoting it or whatever. So, yeah.
That, and also too, the diet is still being sort of, you know, vetted out. We're learning more about different foods that have FODMAPs, how processing affects FODMAPs, and a number of different things. Mm. But to get back to your question, so celiac disease, you know, you have the genes and something trips up in your body that seems to encourage the development of celiac disease. So you're not born with it, but you do have the genes, and something in the environment turns that on. And often for patients, it could be surgery, it could be stress. It's usually an event that sort of introduces sort of the inability to tolerate gluten.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Isn't that, I know, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I thought you were just born with it and it like developed at some point, I guess.
Yeah, no, you can have the genes and never develop it. And then others, there's some kind of environmental trigger, and certainly gluten is one of them, but something else sort of changes the gut microbiome and allows sort of this autoimmune condition to develop in some people. When we think about SIBO, probably the biggest thing to do to prevent getting SIBO is to never get foodborne illness, because there is a connection with developing foodborne illness. In some people, this will go on to contribute to small intestinal paralysis, partial paralysis. So in other words, your small intestine is not moving or cleaning itself as adequately as it should. And because of that, bacteria and microbes can accumulate. So, you know, really good practices, not eating off every food truck you see when you're on travel in Thailand, for instance.
I just went to Thailand, well, a year ago, and we had this huge discussion about food trucks, and everyone was like fearful, and we were so cautious about our fruits. So I don't know, that just hit home with me. That's a huge thing. That's real.
And it's a real thing. And I think, you know, we do have to be really careful about, you know, just making just, you know, not fearful, but being careful not to get foodborne illness, because that is a risk factor for developing SIBO. The other thing I see in my practice, and we do need to see this kind of vetted out in the research, but I see this time in and time again, and that is just constipation, not emptying your colon properly. It's a huge problem. I would say 99% of the patients I see in my practice have constipation. Some don't even realize they're constipated because they may poop every day, but they're not pooping it all out.
So how do you know? How do you know?
Well, in some cases, when we question that and click, I will send the patient back to their GI doctor, and the GI doctor will order what we call a KUB x-ray, and they'll actually just do a quick x-ray of their belly, and they can see if it's full of stool. We don't recommend they do this constantly, but if we question that as part of their picture, it can really give us a good indication if they're emptying their colon properly. The reason why that's really important is because when you have too much stool in your colon, your small intestine doesn't move as properly and doesn't cleanse itself as well. And
makes
so
sense.
If we can really keep people flowing and moving, it can really make a difference. So I see that as a really big problem. And then just avoiding, you know, junk. There's some animal studies, not, of course, we can't always compare them to what would happen in humans, but some really interesting studies out of Georgia State where they looked at the effect of emulsifiers that are found in a number of processed foods, breads, ice creams, salad dressings, and they cause small bowel inflammation and SIBO in these animals. So, you know, just trying to kind of clear out your closet, your pantry of all those, you know, of all the excess processed foods, you know, try to just stick with more foods in its natural state when possible.
Of course.
You know?
Yeah.
Right. I know. Just
that's what this whole show is about, you know, just hitting it home from every angle, from the skin angle, from the mood angle, from the digestion angle, just no matter which angle you approach it, you got to eat real food. Bottom line.
Right.
Plants. Unless you're on a low FODMAP diet, then we'll discuss what you can eat. But how could like a common folk at home, I don't know, start to gather some awareness about whether or not they're constipated without doing the x-ray? I mean, do you have like a rule of thumb for pooping?
You know, my kind of rule of thumb is that everyone should poop every day.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's a couple little exceptions. If, you know, you've been, you know, GI symptom free forever, and, you know, you poop every other day, then, you know, you're probably fine with that. But for most of my patients, I want them pooping every day.
At least once.
Yeah. And if the poop is like deer pebbles, you know, little rocks, then, you know, that's telling you something. That poop's been in there a long time. The longer it stays in your colon, the more water gets sucked out of it. So the drier it is, the more of a red flag that is that you're not eliminating.
Oh, well, my fiance, when his grandmother was at her end of her life, she was like kind of senile. And he has this funny story where I guess she went to the bathroom and came out and told everyone that she had dry duty balls.
Yeah, there you go.
So every time either of us experience that, we announce it to the other one. We're very intimate in our household about our dry duty balls.
That is hilarious. Yeah, you don't want the dry duty balls, okay? So just saying. So we really want to keep things moving. And those are a couple signs that maybe you're not eliminating as appropriately as you should. And that could potentially be a risk for SIBO. At least that's what I see in my clinic.
And also, I mean, risk for SIBO, it's also, for me, was my struggle with IBS. I mean, that's how I knew that was my problem. You know, I know, at least for what I believe or what I'm aware of, is that IBS people are either prone to constipation, I guess, or prone to diarrhea, right? Is that
right?
Their suit?
You're right.
I feel like when I was getting diagnosed with it, they weren't, there wasn't the like IBS-C. That wasn't a thing. I don't know. Maybe I just wasn't aware of it. I just thought there was just IBS. And then towards recent years, they've like added the proneness. But I mean, that's just in general, you don't want to be constipated, you know, SIBO or not.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Get it out. Move it out is a good idea for everyone. But certainly for the clients that I see, I'm more on top of that because of their risk for developing SIBO again.
Yeah. And what are some tips you offer people for pooping like pros? I had to. Sorry.
some pro pooping tips. Well, you know, a number of different things. So it depends on the presentation, but for some patients, you know, using a squatty potty, I'm all over that. Mm-hmm. So for your listeners that might not know about a squatty potty, it's just a little portable kind of stool that goes around your toilet, and it encourages your knees to be above your hips, which opens up the colon canal and allows for easier elimination of poop.
Yeah. So that works. As seen really on Shark good. Tank.
Yes.
And I met the founder casually in passing at like an expo last year. And I was introduced and like, this is the founder of Squatty Potty. I was like, wow, you are changing lives left and right. So funny.
Totally. I think it's like the second most successful item to come out of Shark Tank. So that tells you a lot about how many people are constipated.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So I think the squatty potty is awesome. Sometimes we will add a little magnesium, mm-hmm. you know, just to add a little water to the intestine to loosen up the poops a little bit. Adding a variety of different fibers can be helpful. Chia seeds help a lot of my patients. So we add those, and just oatmeal, a number of different kinds of whole grain fibers, just to add a little bit of bulk to the stool can help. And then lastly, a lot of my patients, and it sounds kind of, you know, maybe a little bit out there, but a lot of my patients do really well with pelvic floor physical therapy. And that's where the muscles are, you know, sort of massaged and relaxed to work on better elimination patterns. And that's with a specialized physical therapist.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, regarding magnesium, that's one thing that saved me and helps me still with constipation. Do you like Natural Calm?
We use Natural Calm, and sometimes, you know, some of my patients don't like the citric acid flavor.
Okay.
And so once I kind of titrate the amount I often use it first to kind of figure out what's a good dose. Mm-hmm. And then I might switch them over to Nature's Made or a pill form, which works well as well. And then they're not really have to drink it down.
Okay. So for people that don't love the flavor. Works. Yeah. I also have used Oxy powder in the past. Do you know that one?
I don't know that one.
Oh, I forget who makes it, but I believe it's a really clean, it's very expensive. So I believe it's clean and high end, but it's like another like mega dose of magnesium with the calcium. Is it calcium they blend it with?
Like sometimes they'll blend with like a calcium blend. Yeah. The main thing is, you know, trying to keep the dosing in a safe range. So usually for my patients, it's no more than 450 milligrams. And I'll usually work with the GI doctor just so we're all on board with what's going on and what we're using. You don't want to overdo it. Some people think more is better. And
why? What's bad about overdoing it?
Just because it will compete with other nutrients in its absorption.
Okay.
So you want to make sure that you're not impacting, you know, the nutritional status. So yeah, it's just important to keep it in check.
That's really helpful. And when you say add chia seeds to your diet for this purpose, do you just suggest like a tablespoon in a smoothie or a chia pudding, or like what's your go-to suggestion when you suggest people incorporate chia seeds?
Yeah. So, you know, all of the above, any way they like it.
Okay.
So blend it into a smoothie or a smoothie bowl is wonderful. I usually start with about a tablespoon. If they're really sensitive and I'm not sure how they're going to tolerate any kinds of fiber, I might start slower. Mm-hmm. But I'm usually shooting for a low FODMAP portion, a couple tablespoons is suitable. But I wouldn't give a patient generally that just because that's about 10 grams of fiber at a whack, and that may or may not be tolerated. Some of my patients like chia pudding. I make chia pudding occasionally, but my personal favorite is blending it into a smoothie.
Yeah, super easy. You don't even know they're there, really.
Right, exactly.
All right.
They make it nice and thick and yummy.
Yes, I know. It's perfect. Okay, ready? Now it's time for the low FODMAP 101 class because we've teetered around the topic and we're, you know, diving in because I know everyone listening is probably like, okay, get to the low FODMAP. So we're there. Here we go.
All right.
What is a low FODMAP diet?
Well, let's start with FODMAPs, okay? So
yes.
Maybe that'll help.
Thanks.
So FODMAPs are basically a certain group of fibers and sugars found in a number of foods, from apples, pears, watermelon, wheat, garlic, onion, and they are poorly absorbed. And when they're poorly absorbed in the intestine, they do two things. Either drag in water, because they're small carbohydrates, they'll pull water in. It's just sort of the way our bodies work. Or because they're small, they're easily accessible by our gut microbes, and they will eat the FODMAPs. They love FODMAPs. They're like fast food to them, and they will create copious amounts of gas. Mm. And that water and gas can make you feel bloated and crampy. If you're more prone to diarrhea, it may throw you right to the bathroom. If you're more prone to constipation, it might feel like you have a water balloon inside your gut. Mm. And just leads to a cascade of miserable symptoms in individuals that have a sensitive intestine.
Okay.
For everyone else, the 85% of Americans, let's say, FODMAPs are healthy.
Right.
So they're really only to be limited to your personal tolerance to manage symptoms.
Okay. I like that you clarified that.
Yeah.
What does FODMAP stand for?
So it's an acronym with a lot of science terms.
Ugh.
So I know, right? So I'm going to say them really quickly and then you never need to hear them again.
And we can read more about them in your book.
That's right. So F stands for fermentable. That means creates gas.
Thank you.
The O stands for oligosaccharides. And it's a big, long word that basically is different types of fibers, fructans, galacto-oligosaccharides that are commonly found in beans, some nuts like cashews and pistachios, cause a lot of gas, basically.
Mm-hmm.
The D in FODMAP stands for disaccharide, meaning lactose, which is a two-chain sugar. The M is monosaccharide, which stands for fructose. And the PA is and.
I love that. The A is and.
And the P is polyols. And polyols are sugar alcohols. They're found in gum and mints and mm-hmm. sugar-free products, but also naturally in food as well. So sorbitol is found in things like blackberries, where mannitol is a polyol, and it's found in cauliflower and watermelon. So there's a number of different sugar alcohols or polyols in foods as well.
Okay, thank you for that. And it is in your book. I'm reading it right now. That's how I knew that the A was an and on page 7. So a low FODMAP diet then is just eating a low amount of these foods.
So let's, yeah. So basically what it is, let me back up. It's actually, it's a three-phase diet.
Okay.
So the first part of the low FODMAP diet is called the elimination phase. And that's when all the high FODMAP foods are removed from the diet. And usually within 2 days, people that are sensitive to FODMAPs will notice a marked difference in their symptoms. But some people take longer. We follow it usually that phase 2 to 6 weeks just to sort of calm the gut down and assess, is this person FODMAP sensitive? If they feel great by 6 weeks, with many people do, 50 to 70% of patients with IBS feel better, then we do what we call the reintroduction or the challenge phase. This is the second part of the low FODMAP diet. And this is when we sort of systematically add back FODMAPs from the different groups that I just mentioned, the disaccharides, the lactose, the monosaccharides, the fructose. And we select a certain food that only has that FODMAP that we want to see if it's a trigger for that person. Mm. So for instance, if I was checking to see if fructose was a trigger in my patient, I would maybe have them add back a little bit of honey or a little mango back into their diet, because both of those only have fructose as their FODMAP source. They don't have any other. So I'm not muddying the test. I'm just determining, is fructose a problem for this patient? And if after a few days of testing, if they don't develop any symptoms, then we put a little note okay with fructose. And then we move on to the next challenge. And we do that for all the different FODMAPs. And it usually takes about 6 weeks, give or take, depending on how the patient does it. And then lastly is the reintroduction phase. I mean, is the sort of the integration phase. And that part is where we start saying, okay, Josie was able to tolerate honey and she was able to tolerate onion, let's slowly add that back to her everyday meal plan and see how she feels. So the goal really is not to be on the diet, the low FODMAP diet forever. We should not be on it strictly because there are some FODMAP sources that are actually good for our gut bacteria. We want to just do it as strictly as necessary to keep our symptoms managed.
I think that is a major misconception from my experience and conversations I've had with people. It appears to me that many people think that you're supposed to just eat low FODMAP-ly forever. Like, this is how I eat now. And I think we need to just, take a moment to hit that home that it's not supposed to be a forever thing. It's really just like a hardcore elimination diet to determine which of the FODMAPs are, really causing you digestive distress.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do you find that some people think it's a forever thing?
I think there's so much misinformation online and all these pseudoscientists that really look like they know what they're talking about in the area of digestive health that are pushing that message out there. So yeah, I think certain people, especially SIBO patients, they think they need to be on it forever. And that's just not the way. It's such misguided information and could really do harm in the long run. It's not the goal.
I mean, you can't eat this way forever. When you look at the list of foods that you should not be eating, what can you even eat? You couldn't eat this way forever and be like a sane person, it seems.
Well, I have to argue with you a little bit on that.
Okay, do it.
I really do think that the diet actually is pretty, I was surprised, when you really look at it, other than wheat and garlic and onion. So yeah, dining out is tricky on the low FODMAP diet, but you can make some pretty yummy foods. There's so many fruits and vegetables that are still low FODMAP. So I think when you kind of put it together, when patients come to see me, they're surprised at how much they can actually eat. It is a little shift in their paradigm with maybe the way they're used to eating.
Right.
But you still can eat a pretty varied diet. But that being said, if you can eat more, eat more.
Right. Yeah. So, okay. I'm looking at for fruit, you have low FODMAPs are like bananas, blueberries, cantaloupe, but high FODMAPs, which I guess when you say high FODMAP, that you should avoid those when you're doing the elimination, right?
Right.
So that's like apples, blackberries, cherries. It seems like there's no real to the modern, like common folk like myself, like you would think that blackberries and blueberries would be in the same category, either low or high together, because I think they're so similar, but it's interesting. Blueberries are low FODMAP and blackberries are high FODMAP.
Exactly. I know. And it's one of these diets where you think theoretically this should make sense.
Yeah.
But there isn't that sort of logical human thought process with FODMAPs. It sort of defied that a little bit.
Very sciencey. That's why we need an expert like you to actually walk us through it rather than some common folk.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
So is there any way to test besides trying it, if a FODMAP diet, low FODMAP could help you? Like, is there any way of knowing it's worth to go on this journey ahead of going on the journey? Does that make sense?
I know. So yeah, it totally does. Okay. And the answer is not yet, but soon, I think.
Oh.
So there is some interesting developments looking at different types of fecal microbiota, different types of microbes that are in your colon may help determine who will benefit from a low FODMAP diet versus who won't. So they are developing different products to help kind of figure out who will be able to benefit versus who won't.
Uh-huh. But if before these tests are really, common, what type of person listening might think, I should try this? Is there any harm in your mind if somebody has digestive distress and maybe they haven't been diagnosed necessarily? They haven't gone through all the steps of being diagnosed with IBS or being diagnosed with SIBO or anything. I mean, do you think if you're struggling digestively, it's worth embarking upon this?
I'd say no.
Okay.
I'd say no. tentatively. So I'd say first visit with your doctor because we don't want to miss something. You know, what if you have inflammatory bowel disease or celiac disease and you haven't been tested for it? You start modifying your diet and now the blood test to test for celiac is no longer accurate because you've already removed most of the gluten from your diet. Even though the low FODMAP diet isn't gluten-free, we do modify FODMAPs because we remove wheat. I mean, we modify gluten because we remove wheat. So visit with the doctor first because, yes, it may help you, but let's make sure we're not missing something and let's make sure we do some testing first to make sure we're not missing some of the big guys first.
Gotcha.
And then go from there. So, yeah, I really encourage people to at least visit, you know, with the gastroenterologist. Now, say you were feeling gassy and you wanted to, you know, modify some of the FODMAPs, like maybe I'll just try cutting down on onion and garlic because I see here they're kind of gassy. Mm-hmm. And maybe that'll help reduce my gas. And it does. And they feel great, you know, something like that. But to do a full blown elimination and all of that, I think diagnosis first, or at least have someone, you know, check in on you and make sure we're not missing something.
Right. Okay. Well, that was a question I was going to ask, is that can some people be sensitive to just like some of the FODMAPs, which I guess the answer is yes.
Yeah.
And that's absolutely what you try to actually determine by doing the diet, right? Which ones are you are sensitive to?
That's right. Exactly. And, you know, one of the things, you know, just I came to my mind, and whether it's relevant here or not, but, you know, again, FODMAPs will cause gas in everyone, but gas isn't a bad thing. So having a little bit of gas is actually just telling us that our bacteria are eating and feeding and they are good for us. And that's a good thing. When the gas is painful, that's not fun. That's when we would then say, well, the FODMAPs may be contributing to a negative symptom. So gas itself, if it's not painful or really bothersome for people, like passing a little gas is actually a healthy thing, just to differentiate, because some people will go on the low FODMAP diet and their gas becomes almost non-existent. And then they start challenging the FODMAPs and they get a little gassy and they're like, well, I'm a little gassy. And it's like, well, that's okay. That's normal. So there is this difference in expectations sometimes, even with my patients, you know, when they're challenging FODMAPs, I say to them, you know, you may get a little more gassy, you may feel a little bloated, but if it's not really a negative, like you're not in pain or the bloating doesn't restrict your breathing pattern, you know what I mean?
Your pants like, don't explode.
Exactly. Like, is it really negative? Have you really failed that challenge?
That I appreciate you saying right. That. A little gas is normal. Don't panic.
Right.
What exactly. Would you say? I mean, just for my own selfish question, my experience when I have stomach issues, which I don't really anymore, and I want to talk about why that is with you in a sec, but it's that my stomach like hurts to the touch. What is that? Is that painful gas? It doesn't feel like gas. I'm not gas, but it's sometimes my stomach feels like it's a little bruised almost.
Yeah. So it could be a number of different reasons. So, and it gets a little complicated, but I'll try to just kind of highlight a couple things. Interestingly, when you do have fermentation in the upper intestine, the small intestine, those microbes, in addition to producing gas, they stretch the intestine. And what lines the intestine are mast cells. And mast cells dump these inflammatory chemicals, and they tend to be located near our nerves. So this dumping, the stretching in the small intestine activates the mast cells to dump these inflammatory chemicals right by the nerve. So it can be like a little bit of a nerve pain that people experience. The other thing that can happen is that when bacteria consume FODMAPs, for instance, or undigested carbohydrates, they produce short-chain fatty acids. So they make kind of a low acidic, you know, very acidic environment. And it could be that that acidity level is kind of irritating your gut. There's a number of metabolites also that are produced when microbes are fermenting carbohydrates, and some of them contribute to inflammation. So there are some gram-negative bacteria that produce something called LPS or lipopolysaccharide, and that can cause inflammation and gut permeability. And so it's complicated, and you know, probably there's a number of different factors. Some of them overlap. Some of them might be just on their own. But yeah.
All right. Thanks. Little selfish question for a selfish answer. Thank you. What are your thoughts on stress affecting the gut? You know, I know for me, and this is what I wanted to say before, I would say, you know, I have a digestive allergy to stress, probably even more than food. I mean, at first I cleaned up my diet when I, you know, realized I had IBS. I, you know, cut out dairy, animal products. Then I went hardcore raw vegan. Then I just went regular vegan. Now I'm pescatarian, whatever. I've, you know, been on my own journey. But I would say my body doesn't care if I'm eating plants or whatever. If I'm stressed eating my kale, my stomach is still going to hurt. So right. I'm curious what your thoughts are on stress. And also, I mean, I know that low FODMAP eating can be very stressful for people. So how do you like not negate the effects of this beneficial diet by being super stressed about it if stress does contribute to digestive issues?
Yeah. So stress can impact digestive issues on it. And I'm a stress digestive issue person for sure. Whenever I get up in front of a big group to do a talk, my stomach just, I think it just stops moving. And I by the time I leave talking, I'm like, oh, I have a huge stomach ache. I don't know what that is. But one of the things that happens with stress is that your intestinal movements do slow down a little bit. So you could accumulate a little bit more gas and stretch that intestine a little bit more. The other thing that happens with stress is that the stress hormones, again, activate those mast cells, and those mast cells start dumping some of those inflammatory compounds again. And people with IBS tend to have more mast cells than the general population. So they're definitely a player there. And so I think the combination of maybe mast cells getting sort of activated and dumping chemicals by your nerves and the slowed down motility of your small intestine kind of allows more gas to trap and bloat and can make people feel worse. Those are at least a couple mechanisms that may be in play with stress.
Yeah. So how do you then suggest that people don't be stressed while being on this diet? Like, do you have any advice? Because it is so restrictive.
So again, I don't think it's that restrictive done in the right hands. And I think that honestly, and the research shows this, that when individuals are educated by a knowledgeable dietitian, the implementation of the diet is much easier and much tastier. That's science. They've looked at that.
Fascinating.
So I think really working with a dietitian that can look at what you normally like to eat, modify that slightly for FODMAPs and help, you know, make it a tasty diet and a doable diet that makes sense from what individuals normally like to eat. And the other thing is FODMAPs, it's not an allergy. It's not gluten and celiac disease. These are not, you know, going to lead to an anaphylactic shock if you have a little onion. It might cause some symptoms, but it's not going to lead to life-threatening consequence.
Right.
So, you know, if it's pizza night and you want a piece of pizza and you're in the middle of the elimination diet, you know what? You might just eat the pizza and you might pay the fiddler, but don't lose control, you know. Keep it where it is. This isn't a food allergy.
Right.
So, and not to say that food intolerance isn't debilitating and miserable. I don't want to say that, oh, geez, it's only food intolerance.
Right.
But I just, you know, put it where it is. Mm-hmm. It's not going to bring you into the hospital, hopefully. Just, you know, do the best you can.
Right. I appreciate you saying that for sure. Like if you have a wedding, I mean, I just know from experiences with friends who are on a low FODMAP diet, like they don't go out to eat for that whole time. I mean, so that's, I guess, what makes me think it's restrictive and also looking at it. But let me just clarify. I'm looking at the list right now in your book, literally. It says vegetables and legumes, low FODMAP, moderate FODMAP, high FODMAP. There's no FODMAP, right? Low is the lowest, right?
Right.
So
right.
You can eat the low ones while you're on the diet, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So, all right. So I'm getting ahead of myself. So for vegetables, the only ones you really have to avoid, reading from your book, are artichokes, asparagus, cauliflower, garlic, leeks, mushrooms, onion, garlic powder, shallots, and then beans, peas, cabbage, sugar, snap peas, snow peas, and soybeans. But you can eat all other vegetables, really.
Really? Yeah.
Okay.
For the most part, you can. And so, yeah, it's not that. And think of all the fruits. I mean, cantaloupe, grapes, strawberries, blueberries, kiwi, oranges, bananas. Mm-hmm. You know, there's portion restrictions on bananas. But, yeah. You know, for the most part, lots and lots of fruits.
Right.
So, you know, when just to back up to your discussion with, you know, people afraid to go out, I mean, that is not what we want. We okay. want people to be able to dine out. And, you know, there are ways to do that.
What are some of those ways?
So, you know, just calling the restaurant during non-busy hours and saying, hey, listen, I love that salmon looks really good on your menu. Is it possible to just get it plain brushed with olive oil? Do you guys have a gluten-free crust? I'm wondering if you could do like a pizza with just like brushed with olive oil, tomatoes, mozzarella, and fresh basil on top, like a margarita pizza, but, you know, on a gluten-free crust. Mm-hmm. Is that possible? Is that something that's going to, you know, throw my waiter upside down? You know, do you add any onion and garlic to your burgers? Wondering if I could just get a burger and bring my own roll. What do you put in your French fries? Can I, you know, do you have just plain baked potatoes? Can I get a salad without onion in it? Mm-hmm. I just want to put shrimp and shrimp on it and da, 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 da. So calling restaurants can be helpful. I do have on my website at katescarlotta.com these under the FODMAP resources, it's called grab and go passes. And there's one for the chef, and you can hand that to the chef that can just really highlight some of the big real FODMAPs at restaurants are wheat, onion, and garlic. I mean, the other ones tend to be very obvious in the menu.
Right. I mean, because onion and garlic is in like every single sauce or dressing you're going to consume, really, at a restaurant. Yeah.
But, you know,
you can still do olive oil and balsamic, right, on a salad.
Right. Yeah.
Or lemon.
And you can do sushi. A lot of omelets are good. Oatmeal with fruit and nuts. A lot of my patients do salads out or do like a rice salad bowl or do a gluten-free pizza that's made like I just mentioned. You know, and when I had SIBO, for instance, I knew there was one restaurant locally that had a turkey club and they put it on sourdough bread. So sourdough wheat bread is low FODMAP. And they would do a turkey club. And I felt great whenever I had that. So my poor husband took me there, like, I think every weekend. It was like the one meal that like just always worked for me. And I didn't really know about FODMAPs at the time, but, you know, just kind of interesting. But I think, you know, certain restaurants will work for people and they'll kind of learn. And there's, you know, there are resources to help.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like it's really about communication and your perspective. I mean, if you go into it, this whole diet thinking like, God, this sucks. Like, I can't eat onions. You know, this is the bummer. I have to ask my chef in advance, like, what kind of person am I? Versus like, okay, like I'm just gonna, and then like you said, I'm just gonna call and see if they can do the salmon plain. Like that's a very different perspective on the situation. And I think that's really what it comes down to, because like I love how throughout this I keep saying, but low FODMAP's so hard. And you're like, no, it's not, because that's your perspective. And I think, you know, I guess I want to encourage everybody listening to also have your perspective, which is like, no, it's not so hard. You just have to politely and confidently communicate. And, you know, it's not that big of a deal.
Totally. And, you know, it really isn't. And I think, you know, being prepared, if you're traveling, you know, a lot of my patients will pack their own little oat bags with their, you know, chia seeds and walnuts and get fruit when they get there. And, you know, there's lots of little tricks up, you know, that we just implement and help our patients navigate. They're going to be on an airplane flying to Australia for, you know, 20 hours. We want to make sure they have what they need that will make their belly feel well. There's low FODMAP food companies are emerging, Fodi Foods, which I consult with, but they're doing a number of certified low FODMAP items, from granola bars to salad dressings to salsa to marinara. Like, so there are ways to make this diet a lot easier to implement and tasty and not feel like you're depriving yourself, you know, and feel well, you know, finally. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's it. That's the goal, right?
Yeah. I mean, and if that is your goal and if you believe this can help you, then truthfully, you're going to want to avoid those things, you know, with joy. I mean, like, I know that I'm not going to eat meat because meat doesn't digest well with me and I don't want to eat it. So I don't walk around life thinking, oh, this sucks. It's so hard to eat this way because like I can't eat meat. Like it's, you know, I don't eat it and it's fine. I don't know.
No, I totally understand. Your body will start. Same with me. You know, after I have my surgery, I can't do a boatload of fat at one time. Mm-hmm. And so I can eat fat but just not a boatload. So, right. You know, years ago, I would chow down Chinese food, or I maybe would have a huge plate of French fries with my whatever. And I, you know, obviously as a dietitian, I don't really do that all the time, but there are times that I would really like to do that. But you know what? Right now, my body is like, you know what? Usually my husband will order fries. I'll order a baked potato. We'll split it. I'll have a few fries. I'm happy. Mm-hmm. I don't need to have, you know, 5 cups of French fries.
Right.
You know? And that's okay because my body is saying that.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting in my practice. I do not have to motivate people. They come to me. They've been sick for 10 years. It's affected their ability travel, their ability to work outside of the home, everything.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you say, just try this. And in 3 days, they feel better, 2 days.
Right.
It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I guess if you look at it that way,
totally,
you can be motivated to do it, just like you've given up meat. And right. I really don't eat meat either.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, I get it. If it works for you, you know, you want to feel.
So what if you, you know, do the elimination test and you realize that, you know, you have an issue with one of the FODMAPs, not the A because that's and, but like, you know, like onions, which isn't a FOD. What is that one again? That is.
It's an oligosaccharide source.
Okay. Thank you. Just curious. Oh, that makes sense. Oh, an onion. I mean, that's not related, but does that mean you avoid onion forever?
So you can retest your tolerance like throughout, because your gut microbiota does change. You know, the community of microbes changes over time. And so it's possible to retry the onion. You can try smaller amounts of onion. And you may try cooked onion versus raw onion and find that there's some tolerance. Some of my patients are able to have things that have little bits of onion in it, like a ketchup or something, or a little bit of broth doesn't seem to be a problem. So it's really just trying to find within that. The other thing is that for onion flavor in a low FODMAP diet, you can use the green part of spring onions, like scallions. You can use chives. And there's actually a scallion-infused oil that is really nice from a company called Boyajian. And you can get that like at Whole Foods, but that'll give a nice onion flavor without the FODMAPs.
Gotcha.
And same with garlic. So garlic, again, small amounts of garlic might be okay, but not having, you know, smearing roasted garlic over your crostini might not be okay.
Mm-hmm.
So it's finding that magic place. And if you find, geez, I'm very sensitive to garlic, even the smallest amounts, then try garlic-infused oil. So Fodi Foods has garlic-infused oil, Boyajian. There's a number of brands now that are coming out with garlic-infused oil. And that gives you all the lovely garlic flavor without the FODMAPs.
Gotcha. So the answer, besides the specific tips on the garlic and the onion, which is very helpful, and I'll link what you said in the show notes for people, but is if you discover that one of the FODMAPs is a trigger, I guess, for you, or it hurts your stomach or whatever, yes and no that you have to avoid it forever. I mean, like at least for me, I used to think I was allergic to all onion because every time I ate onion, this was before FODMAP even – I was aware of it. This was 8 years ago. I thought onion killed my stomach. But then I realized, wait, hold on. It's just raw onion. I can eat cooked onion all day. And so I don't eat raw onion and I can still eat onion. So yes, you have to be aware of it. But no, it's not necessarily a life sentence. And yes, you can try to play around with whatever your sensitivity is and see what might work and, you know, for you, right?
Exactly what you said.
Nailed it.
Exactly. Nailed it.
Do you follow a low? I mean, the answer is no. You don't follow a low FODMAP diet, right?
I don't follow a strict low FODMAP diet, but I do know that if I had a boatload of FODMAPs presented to me on a plate, I would feel ill. So
there are
that, like a big Mexican enchilada might not be a good plan for Kate Scarlatta. However, if I did a little bit of cooked onion on something or a little bit of garlic on something. I can do wheat up to a point, like a half a bagel sits really well for me, but a whole bagel, I will feel crampy. Mm. It will not ruin my day, but I will know that I ate the whole bagel.
Gotcha.
So it's definitely a portion driven thing for me.
Okay.
Makes it a little difficult because I'm married to an Italian that loves pasta and pizza and would eat that every day of his life. But he's been really good about, you know, eating my way.
That's really good. That's great. Is there is there a pasta you can eat on a low FODMAP? Can you do like rice pasta or something or no?
Yeah. So you can do most gluten-free pastas work well. And, you know, if people don't overdo their portion in wheat pasta, a lot of them can do the wheat pasta. It's again, most of FODMAP intolerance is portion driven. So it's trying to find where that portion limit is for that individual and meeting it. Because why limit your diet if you don't need to?
Right. Let me ask you this, and I'll let you go soon. I know we have to go soon, but I just love talking to you.
Yay,
thanks. Okay, so then I won't let you go soon. No, just kidding. Anyway, can probiotics or digestive enzymes, you know, I know those are totally separate things, but I guess can digestive enzymes, if taken with a food, FODMAP-y food that you're sensitive to, help at all or no, not at all?
So there has been one study looking at that, and the enzyme, the galacto something ACEs that are found in Beano, in those products like Bean Enzyme or Bean Digest, there's different products. Those actually have been shown in individuals with IBS when taken with beans to minimize symptoms. So that is proven. Other digestive enzymes, just in general, like taking a broad spectrum digestive enzyme that you get at Whole Foods or something, I have not seen a lot of benefit in my patients, and I haven't seen really any specific data on that in the research, but patients that have tried it, and I tried it too when I had SIBO because I was so desperate, and I can't say that I personally noticed any benefit. There are some people that don't really make enough pancreatic enzymes, and that's a whole other can of worms. Mm-hmm. There's testing to do for that. There's special stool tests and the doctor can look at that. But I think in general, most people from my experience, it might be try it, but outside of the Bean Assist and Beano products kind of like that with FODMAP and bean intake, that's the only one that I know that's really more science-based.
Okay. I found that digestive enzymes really helped me, but not necessarily for the FODMAP issues. Like I couldn't eat raw onion and have digestive enzymes and be chilling. They help me if I eat something like French fries, which just aren't easy to digest, but it give me a little boost. Do you think that's valid?
It's very possible. Like I said, it's very individual. We just don't have a lot of information. And my experience with clients hasn't been very positive, but that's not to say that they're not helpful. And I don't dissuade my patients from trying them if they're still symptomatic and they want to, you know, that's fine. And, you know, but I personally just haven't seen a lot of benefit, but, you know, again,
recommend it all the time. So I don't want to be like, I don't want people listening to be like, you're a jerk. You recommend it. And she's saying it doesn't work. I'm trying to get you to say it works, but you can't.
It might work for some people.
I know.
That's the gray area. So
totally. Gotcha.
Yeah.
What about like other wellness practices, like perhaps like stress management practices, like acupuncture, or meditation, or exercise? Have you found that those things have helped your patients and clients?
So, you know, there's some interesting research actually in this area. So hypnotherapy actually has excellent research and can be very, very beneficial in patients with IBS. It has long-standing results.
Cool.
In fact, they compared the low FODMAP diet to clinical hypnotherapy using like a gut-directed hypnotherapy script, and both groups on that study benefited from symptom management equally.
Wow.
So there is definitely very, very interesting. So a good hypnotherapist can be awesome. The other area that's really interesting is we use a lot of GI psychologists, and this is an emerging area. And this really focuses on some of the psychological aspects of living with digestive, chronic digestive health illness. But there's lots of different sort of interventions that the GI psychologist would use. Some of them is just like deep diaphragmatic breathing that can really relax the gut. And then even just walking through sort of this like catastrophic thinking, because when you've been living with something, like some people are have had, you know, episodes of, you know, literally shitting their pants on, you know, at the grocery store, you know, have really serious things. And so working through some of those fears so that they can get back out in living and trust their body again. So GI psychologists can be really helpful. Some of my patients find acupuncture very helpful. I can't say the data is strong on that in the literature, but I definitely have witnessed and observed acupuncture being done, and this looks extraordinarily relaxing.
Yeah, I love, I swear by it.
Yeah, I think it's really worth trying. And then the other thing is yoga.
Okay.
So yoga has some really good evidence to help with IBS symptoms. So that is another sort of evidence-based approach. And then just also too, for those prone to constipation, doing some impact type exercises. So whether it's a light jog, you know, engaging in a class where there's maybe some jumping jacks and kind of jostling around the intestine, it actually can be helpful for some people in kind of getting their lazy gut to move a little bit.
Oh, I'm one of those people. I can't tell you how many times I'm on a run and I'm like, oh shit, literally. And then I have to, you know, come home. I mean, I got my methods for clenching and then making it home in time, but I can count on my run to get things going, which is great.
Definitely. No, I exactly. And I know it sounds like people are, you know, like, oh, I walk. And I'm like, well, you know, sometimes it's a little bit more of a jarring movement that can just kind of wake up that intestine a little bit.
I love it. That's so funny. Awesome. Well, I have a few final plant party questions for you, personal questions.
Okay.
Do you have a favorite plant party, low FODMAP friendly restaurant?
Jeez,
you're
Louise.
In Boston, right?
I am in Boston. Okay. I wish I knew that in advance. Not really.
Really? There's not one low FODMAP place that you know that you send people to?
No.
Wow.
I know. And, you know, this is an area that I'm kind of glad you brought up, because we have tried to partner with restaurants to offer free service to help them modify an item on their menu to make it low FODMAP. And we have not had very good success with them just even embracing that concept.
Why, you think? What's their, they don't think it's trendy enough?
I don't know. They just, you know, oh yeah, we'll talk to, you know, the manager, you know, the whatever. And then it just gets closed and we follow up. And, you know, it's, I can't say that I've, you know, hit up a ton of restaurants, but the majority have not, like, kind of fell on deaf ears, or they say, yeah, this sounds interesting, and then never follow up. And then we try to follow up and no one gets back to us.
Wow.
So it's really interesting. I really like one of my favorite restaurants, and it's really just like a smoothie bowl place, and it works for me, is Cocoa Beet.
Okay.
So it definitely is plant powered, you know, really unique items, and certainly many of them can be suitable for low FODMAPers.
Great. And what's like your go-to cuisine for eating out? Is it sushi? Because my friend Phoebe, when we were going to try to get dinner like last week, when she was like, I'm on this thing and I like can't eat out, she was like, I could do sushi. Was that what you would say your go-to is for people?
Yeah, a lot of times sushi would be good. A lot of Asian dishes actually can be modified pretty easily for low FODMAP. Just, you know, sauces on the side, but a lot of Asian Thai dishes can be pretty good actually. And then, you know, if a restaurant offers gluten-free items, it's pretty easy to do, like I said, like a, you know, a margarita style pizza and a salad works well for a lot of people.
What about soy sauce?
So soy sauce does have gluten, but it is not a FODMAP source.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yes.
Okay, what is your favorite plant to eat?
My favorite plant to eat. I would say I have a lot of favorite plants to eat, but I love arugula.
What's your favorite way to eat it?
So I love it with just fresh lemon, a little Parmesan cheese and olive oil and salt and pepper.
Yes, that's my fave
simple,
too.
So simple, so good. So love that. And I'm kind of a smoothie bowl queen. I probably have one every day. So it's kind of the way I enjoy getting my fruit and blueberries and, you know, a number of different pineapple.
What's your go-to smoothie bowl? I'm now scanning your book to see if you have smoothie bowl recipes.
You know what? That's a good question.
There's a smoothie. There's a green extreme smoothie, an almond oat berry smoothie, mix and match fruit smoothies.
Yes. We had done like a bunch of the mix and match ones. So I do remember that. So my favorite, I definitely do this green energy smoothie bowl from Cocoa Beet. And it has like kale and pineapple and kiwi and just delicious toppings, strawberries, a few strawberries, a little bit of toasted coconut, some hemp seeds. When I make them at home, I mostly do Greek yogurt, blueberries, pineapple, sometimes a little acai, and then I put like yummy toppings.
Like chia seeds.
I always like chia blend seeds. I always blend them in to thicken up my smoothie bowls.
Nice.
But yeah, I'd love to get fruit that way. So it's just yummy and, you know, one-stop shopping.
Decadent, totally. So that said, what's your most used kitchen tool?
Oh, my Vitamix.
I figured that's the direction we were going.
Yeah, definitely like the Vitamix. I use that every single day.
For those smoothie bowls.
For my smoothie bowls. And then if I want to do like a fun pancake and want to blend in like almond flour and maybe some oats and I want to grind them into a flour, it works really well. I love making homemade nut butters.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Are all nuts suitable for a low FODMAP diet?
So most nuts are suitable, but in a certain portion, except for pistachios and cashews, which are both high FODMAP, which of course are my favorite.
Oh, really? That sucks.
It does suck. And but I've learned that like a few cashews are okay. And, but every holiday, my brother-in-law used to have this huge bowl of fancy cashews and I would just stand there and eat them and talk all night. And then every Christmas morning, I would feel so sick and I never connected the dots.
Wow.
I just figured, oh, maybe I had an extra glass of wine, but it never really made sense.
Wow.
And it was those darn cashews.
I mean, that's a perfect example right there, an illustration of the low FODMAP diet, its relevance to our lives. You know, it's not common sense, even to you as a dietitian, that those cashews would upset you based on the fact that you're able to eat other nuts and based on, all the stuff. So I don't know. I just felt like that was like a perfect illustration of how legit this is and also like how obscure it kind of is.
It is totally obscure. It's like watermelon, blackberries, like how do you put these things together? And, in New England, we're such apple and pear people. Where everyone's going apple picking and apple pie and crisp, and it's so yummy and good, but it might be a symptom trigger for some people.
Yeah, apples are tough. I find that I can do green apples, no prob, but like red apples hurt my stomachs usually.
Yep.
And
I think,
normal?
The green, yeah, it is. The green are like have less of the fructose, I think, in them, if I recall that. And so it could be that, you're a little bit more, you would be a little bit more sensitive maybe to the excess fructose. But I find green apples are better tolerated than some of the other apples. And because we have so many varieties and they haven't all been tested, there may be some low FODMAP apples out there that just haven't been analyzed yet. We just don't know.
What is the test like to analyze these things?
I know. So it takes about 2 to 3 weeks. And right now it's only done in Australia. We're trying to get some companies here in the U.S. I mean, there's some testing in the U.S., but very minimal. So it's just a special, they freeze dry the food and they put it through this special machine and it kind of pops out the different kinds of sugars in it. And then they have to treat certain foods with enzymes and then put it back into a different machine. And it just pops out the various degrees of these FODMAP carbohydrates. And then the researchers in Melbourne have sort of delineated certain levels of what would constitute a high FODMAP versus a low FODMAP.
Wow.
And there you go. But it does, it's expensive. It's thousands of dollars for one food. Oof. And it takes 2 to 3 weeks. Although they're, you know, again, I hope that someone takes this over in the US and, you know, it expedites some of the testing because there's still foods, you know, that haven't been tested.
Have you been to the place where they do the testing?
Yes. So really interesting. When I went down there in like 2011, I think it was, I was in the lab and the results for rum was coming out of the machine. And they learned that day that rum is a source of excess fructose. So it is a FODMAP, where like whiskey and vodka and gin are low FODMAP, rum is actually high FODMAP. And that came out of the machine while I was there. That's kind of cool, right?
That's so fun. I figured you'd maybe been there. That's neat.
It was like
it's like your Mecca.
It was like Disney World for me. Seriously. I was like, oh my gosh, I've read every paper you've written, you know?
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, it was very, very cool.
That's cute. That's so funny. So what is a book that's really inspired you in some awesome way?
I really liked Brené Brown's, her latest,
Braving
the Wilderness.
Yep. I've been thinking about getting that on an audiobook, so I might do it now.
Yeah, totally do. It was like, there were moments where I was almost like choked up in tears because it resonated so much with me.
Wow.
And I think it's just, it's a really good book, especially for women and, you know, probably men too, but I think just showing up and being yourself and, you know, some of the different sort of societal things maybe that have impacted some people and not fully being themselves. But I'm the youngest of 9 kids.
Whoa.
So it's, you know, a different, I know, crazy, right? So being in that position, you know, you don't really voice much because you have 8 people ahead of you kind of looking at you like, what do you know? You know? And so there were parts in that book that kind of was like, you do know a lot.
Yeah, you do know a lot.
Yeah, exactly. And just be you and, you know, don't be under those confines of what people, your family or whatever people expect you to be. Mm. So I loved it. I could read that book over and over and certain have highlighted passages in it that just, you know, rang true for me. So
yes, I love that. Okay. I'm sold. I have a credit on Audible right now going towards Braving the Wilderness.
Yes.
Thank you. So what about you and your books? Where should people listening go to learn more about what you have to offer, everything that you know and everything you can say? And what book? I mean, it sounds like the Low FODMAP Diet Step by Step is really the book you would recommend this day and age.
For sure. That's going to be your most up-to-date. It's fresh. It was published December 2017, so couldn't be any fresh off the publishing deck.
Nice.
So yes, that's a really good book. And I partnered with a former Bon Appetit editor. So she created a lot of the recipes, which was really nice because I'm not a chef, although I'm a good cook. It was kind of nice to have someone else get creative in
that's
the kitchen.
Cool. Yeah, we should mention it's a cookbook. It's not just like a guidebook. Yeah, yeah. It's a full-on cookbook.
Yeah, it's a cookbook, but it also has a lot of information to do the diet.
Yes,
so it really provides both ends of it.
Yeah.
The other thing I'd like to mention is for those of people out there that have been touched with IBS or know people with IBS, one of my sort of near and dear work, you know, projects is a campaign that I started last year called I Believe in Your Story.
Yes.
And it's a grassroots campaign to raise awareness about IBS, allow individuals with IBS to share their story as a way to heal, but also to help others heal in this journey. And I've linked on my website two medical institutions that are really leading the charge in research, Mark Pimentel's lab at Cedars-Sinai and Bill Che's lab at UMichigan. He's doing a lot of diet nutrition research in relationship to food intolerances and IBS. So that's just a way to provide research funding, because sadly, IBS patients are allocated 12 cents, that's right, 12 cents per patient from government funding for research. It's pathetic.
Wow.
And so that's an area that's sort of near and dear to me. And additionally, we're working on creating a number of different handouts. I created an app for the low FODMAP diet,
wow,
all in ways to just help people with IBS sort of, you know, live a good life and do the low FODMAP diet as easily as possible. And I have a lot of resources on my website, which is www.katescarlata.com, and under the FODMAP link. And then if you want to listen to my, what I call affectionately, my crying video.
I didn't see that when I was preparing for this.
Yes, I have a video where I talk about my digestive health journey and how difficult it was, and just really kind of spill my guts. I don't cry all
that much. Pun intended.
However, I do. But it's under the I Believe in Your Story tab, and it just says My Story, and you can click there and really learn very authentically who I am and what I'm about. And I'm on Twitter and Instagram too. So I'm always posting low FODMAP tips and inspirational quotes on Instagram. And then I'm at Kate Scarlata, and then Twitter at @KateScarlata_RD on Twitter. And I post a lot of educational, more research oriented materials on Twitter.
Wow. Well, you nailed that question. So many ways to reach you. You're doing so much incredible stuff for the IBS community and the stomach strugglers. And I really couldn't be more grateful that you came on today to educate us and inspire us. Really, thank you so incredibly much.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for listening to the Party in My Plants podcast. Wowza. What did you think? I think that Kate just dumped so much knowledge in this chat that it almost clogged my mental toilet. Instead of stressing about remembering all the deets, how about you hop on over to the show notes where I wrote out all the deets at partyinmyplants.com/78. And instead of hogging this knowledge for yourself, how about you share the FODMAP fun with someone who might also find FODMAPs fun and become their low FODMAP fairy godmother? If this episode really floated your boat, which is not something your poop should do, FYI, float, but I'd really appreciate it if you'd leave a review of my podcast in iTunes so that this episode can get ranked higher by iTunes and spread the low FODMAP fun to everyone. Again, all the FODMAP facts from this show, links to everything we reference, and loads more stuff that makes healthy living not totally suck can be found at partyinmyplants.com/78.